Hi, hello. We have a jam-packed episode of the Dunker Spot coming your way. Heat fans, if you were looking for Heat commentary on Tuesday, we got you covered today. Cooper Moorhead joins us to discuss all things Miami Heat, the shifting offense, elite defense, Bam Awards cases, Tyler Hero fitting in, the young guy sliding in. We talk about all of it and some lineup stuff on top of that. After that, Jason Tatum is returning later tonight. We dig into what we are looking for, and we have a conversation around the recent discourse surrounding Jason Tatum's return and how ridiculous it is, but that's okay. And then, finally, we close with Unrivaled Talk. Miss BC wins the championship in one heck of a game over fans of BC. Kelsey Plum drops 40. Brandon Stewart drops 32. We talk about our favorite moments from that game and talk about the ending and potential changes we may want to see in next year's Unrivaled season. Stay tuned. We hope you enjoy. Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of the Yahoo Sports Network. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me, as always, is my co-host, the always excellent Steve Jones Jr. Steve, happy Friday, sir. How are you?
Hello.
Okay, we have the quick intro from Steve, which means we have a guest, and boy, do we have a guest for today's episode. We have the one, the only Cooper Moorhead of the Miami Heat. Heat Insider, host of the After the Buzzer podcast, purveyor of all things Miami Heat. Coop, welcome to the show. How are you on this Friday?
Fellas, it is great to be here. I just came from my daughter's poetry recital, so I got all kinds of kid stuff in my head, but I'm ready to shift back to Heat mode, and I'm just really happy to be here.
When I tell you, we're going to dig into the conversation shortly. When I tell you, this is like literally years in the making of getting Coop on this here podcast to talk Heat. It has been a fun journey. One of my favorite people in the space, one of my favorite Heat people in particular. This is going to be a fun time. Very happy to get this one done. But let's jump into this Miami Heat season, a team that has long had me in an emotional headlock as someone that grew up a Heat fan. Recording. In the history of the podcast, Steve has also had to deal with my various, this is great, this is awful, but he reels me in all the time. But as of recording, the Miami 34-29, they are 8th in the Eastern Conference right now. They are, currently in the glass, 13th in offensive rating, 4th in defensive rating, they are 11th in net rating, just outside the top 10 on that front. So Coop, just on a very basic level, what were your expectations of this Miami Heat team heading into the year with reported changes coming to the offense, some rotation things, you get the acquisition of Norman Powell. Like, how were you feeling about the Heat heading in, and how's that kind of, you know, how's that kind of matched or maybe exceeded your expectations, or where are you kind of at with them right now?
Yeah, I think they're a little bit along the lines of what I expected, maybe a few, like a win or two above, but not quite, in large parts because, you know, last year with the saga that was going on with the roster, they just never really had a chance to come together, and they were just figuring out who they were going to be in the post-Jimmy era in those 2 months after that deal. So coming to this summer, then you get Norm in the offseason, which, you know, is a great trade. Norm's been awesome. But you kind of come in, Tyler gets hurt a week before training camp. So we spent all the summer talking about Norm and Tyler playing together, and then Tyler gets taken out of the equation for a lengthy period of time. Now you're already readjusting your, you know, calibrating your expectations. And I'm sure you guys were the same way. Every time you hear a coach saying, we're going to play faster, you know, in preseason, it's the same thing as a guy coming in saying, like, I had 15 pounds of muscle. You almost kind of hear it goes in one ear, out the other. You don't really take it too seriously. And even Spo has said it before going into training camp. Spo has wanted to play faster before, and then they come in and maybe they'll play faster for a week, and then all of a sudden their pace is back down, you know, in 20 to 30 range. This year, the pace has been for real. They've stuck with it. And it took a week or so to really wrap my mind around what this offense was going to be, because we've only had, the only presence we've had is what Memphis ran last year without taking all the screens and handoffs out of a system, where the Heat have been a handoff heavy, screen heavy system for a long time. So within, you know, all these managing expectations, and then completely revamping the offense, which I think Spo deserves credit for, because not every coach is going to be willing to just scrap everything they've done before. And he admits he was, you know, pushed into that a little bit based on his reaction to the Cleveland series and how that went. But, you know, I think overall they maybe, you know, give or take a win or two here or there, they're about where maybe you expected them to be. The East has kind of shaped up, I guess, kind of how we expect the East to be as well. But, you know, the 5-6 seed is still possible for them. So if they can climb up to be around there, then I think it's a pretty good season based on where we thought they would be coming in.
I'll keep it there. Excuse me. I'll keep it there and I'll ask this question. Because I think one of the things that has stood out about Miami's season has been their consistency with their pace, with their tempo, with getting the ball up the court. We're going to get into what we do very quickly. We're going to space the floor and we're going to try and drive and kick. How surprised are you that that stuck to a degree? And what kind of nuances do you think people are missing out as far as, it's easy to say, well, they don't run screens and they're trying to do this offensively, but there's a consistent flow to what they do almost every possession that's kind of allowed them to stay in different types of games against different types of opponents.
Yeah, I wouldn't say I'm surprised, just because having known and been around Spo for a long time, when he commits to something, he commits. You know, it's the same thing as when the LeBron, Wade, Bosch teams went full pace and space, because once they install something, they're going to keep, you know, banging that drum constantly until they get it right, until they make it consistent. And it does wax and wane sometimes, but that just takes a practice or a shoot around, and they usually kind of turn it around if the offense goes awry in terms of, you know, the function. You know, the results are going to be here and there. But I don't know if you guys have struggled with this year, but I, like you guys, I love to get into the nitty gritty. I love to find all the little details and everything that they're trying to do. But this offense has almost kind of simplified the game in such a way where there are intricacies. Mm-hmm. And I think you guys would love to talk about the way they cut, the way they sacrifice cut, especially early in possessions, to clear space, to clear empty corners for these kind of one-on-one isolation plays that they don't want to call isolations, but in some ways they are, some ways they are. And those cuts and the way they grind precise precision spacing to make sure the offense functions. But if you kind of look at it from a top-down perspective, it is a little simplified, right? You don't have to worry about four guys running perfect timing sets. You don't have to worry about a lot of times multiple people coming to the ball. And so I think I've struggled with that, to try and find more details than are sometimes there. And that's just my brain going to work and the way we watch basketball, I think, as analysts. But it's also a little liberating, because you can appreciate the game in a different way, because you know every possession they're going to come down, they're just trying to do the same 2, 3, 4, 5 things every time for 80 possessions a game. And a lot of times it works pretty well.
That is a fascinating point that I kind of want to stay on for a little bit, because I agree, like, the simplified nature of it, like, it does take a little bit off the plate mentally. Like, this is how the Heat want to attack. This is how quickly they want to do it. They want to clear space. This is how they clear it. And then it just kind of turns into, how often did they win these possessions? How many times did Davion Mitchell win his drives? How many times did Norm Powell do so? And if those guys do it, Jaime Jaquez, same thing. If those guys win their drives, the Heat are going to drop 125, 130. They're going to win their games. If they do not, then they're going to be getting back in transition, and it's going to be a different look for them. And so, trying to balance that part of it, like, you don't want to come off reductive when talking about the Heat. And I think that's also why, like, for Steve's sake, I try to space out my Heat thoughts on the podcast, because I know I can fluctuate depending on what I'm seeing for a 4 or 5 game stretch. But it's also like, because, to your point, Coop, like, what they do is kind of in your face and simplified to a degree. You kind of just have to let results build before you get into, okay, it's been 6 games of the Heat dropping 125, the offense is operated like this, on defensive end they're doing, we're going to get into the defense a little bit later, but like, they're defending at a level, at a high level, they're winning games. Or teams are now sprinkling in late help on these drives, they're helping off of certain players, funneling shots elsewhere, and this is where the Heat are struggling. And so you get like a group of games before you can really bring something new to the table, because it does just kind of feel result based on how they set that up. So it's fascinating to me. Steve, how have you kind of felt about analyzing Miami as a concept this year?
I think it was more so kind of to Coop's point, for me, it was understanding, okay, what's the purpose at first, right? Like, there's a lot of drives, there's a lot of drive and kick, and then understanding, okay, they're timing their cuts around it very well. And so there's an intention behind what we're trying to do. So we're trying to get the ball up the court and we're trying to make quick decisions. And it's not always going to be an automatic, which I think we are so used to. in today's NBA where, okay, if this happens, I know that's going to happen. That doesn't always happen. If you get a drive, you might get a Heat player space to the wing, a corner cut, someone flowing up from the other corner to the wing. And it's like, okay, they're not going to do that every time, but boy, that looked good. Okay, what's it like when they win a drive? How do they flow to the next portion of it? You know, it's not an automatic, okay, we're getting to a handoff. It's okay, drive, kick, drive, shot. It's like, okay, everyone's just kind of grouping in a different way. And so I think the importance of winning matchup has been key, but it's also kind of them playing with a freedom that's a little bit different. And you see them communicate when they're on the offensive end. If someone's about to drive and look to attack a matchup, you'll see guys pointing to each other, now get in the corner, let's space, let's get ready for the kick. If it comes, let's drive. So it's more so just like, okay, I know what they're trying to do. How does this impact defenses? What happens when teams put physicality and size and length on them? How do they react to that? What are the counters they're trying to get to? And then you kind of dive into, well, they never stop doing this. And so it's like, okay, they're having a hot stretch, but they're not going to stop offensively. They're struggling to start a game, but they're not going to stop offensively. And that was the thing that stood out to me where it's like, ooh, okay, they have a confidence in their pace and their tempo and their ability to drive and play against teams. And so that kind of is what's boggled in my brain. It's not an easy thing to dissect. I wouldn't do the thing that people do and be like, well, look, this offense is brand new. No one's ever done it. And it's not exactly accurate, but you know, it's a team understanding their strengths and trying to find different ways to poke at the teams. And I think the biggest thing is just different because it's Miami. Like, you're so used to, as Coop said, Miami playing a certain way to a degree. And now it's like, nope, we're getting up and down. We're going, everyone's attacking. We're gonna put pressure on you. You got to deal with us. And it's like, oh, okay.
Yeah, it's definitely shocked the system at first.
Yeah, like I think to that point, and circling back to what you said earlier, Coop, kind of circling back to what last year was and them trying to move past the Jimmy Butler era and everything that kind of came with that. It's kind of funny to zoom out to this is Jimmy and Bam. This is Jimmy. Jimmy's out of here to like, hey, what if we empower literally everyone on the roster? Let's just completely zag and make sure everyone kind of has the freedom to explore space and explore the games and expand their games in that way. So that part's been fun. Just to kind of put numbers on things before pushing things forward. Again, the Heat flirting with a top 10 offensive rating, the 13th in offensive rating right now. They're 13th in half court offense. Both figures better than they were last year. They are first in pace. They're first in terms of how quickly their possessions end, about 13 seconds per possession on that front. And the screening has been different. They were in the top 10 last year in both on-ball and off-ball screens set per 100 possessions last year. This year, setting about 18 per 100 on the ball. So the pick and roll volume, incredibly low. They are last in the league. And even to the off-ball portion, which I kind of want to circle back on like how they're spacing around these drives, they're down to around 28 off-ball screens per 100 possessions. And I remember talking with Steve last year as they were trying to figure out what this offense was going to look like. I noted, like, hey, they're like in the top five, top six in terms of how often they're setting flare screens and how often they're setting pin-ins. And like that felt like an uptick from what we had seen for previous Heat teams. So for them to kind of scrap that portion and to be more spacing-based and more cutting-based has been kind of interesting. Like, how have you felt about the kind of off-ball balance with what they're doing around those drives this year, Coop?
Well, I think it is important to note that, like, even though they are super low in on-ball pick-and-rolls, those off-ball screens in a lot of ways can function as a pick-and-roll because even though the ball isn't there, you're still creating an advantage and making the defense react, you know, 20 feet away on the left wing when the ball is on the right wing, just with one of those off-ball screens. And some of it is, I mean, you know, when you don't have Duncan Robinson anymore, Duncan Robinson was a big recipient of plays like that. So that's going to bring your usage down. But then you have Norm Powell, who is one of the best quick decision catch and choose guys in the league. And I think Norm, you know, we can get into Norm and Tyler probably a little bit later, but I think people think of Norm and Tyler as the same kind of player, but they're different in the way that they go about things. Tyler is a much more on-off ball mix, and Norm is much more off ball first, on ball. He catches and he makes his move. So they do have to run a lot of early offense for Norm. And I think, you know, this is kind of one of my favorite stats of the year, is that they're the best offense in the league in the first 3 minutes of the game, statistically. And it's because Norm starts so fast and they'll just immediately go flow right into like first possession of the game. It's either a Bam post up or isolation if they like that matchup, or it's Norm flying off the weak side wing off a screen, off a pin down and catching, and he'll just fire away, you know, first possession of the game within the first 5 seconds. So it creates an interesting flow. And again, I think we're just going to keep coming back to this thing of they have to, the offense is constantly about cutting and relocating and finding empty space and filling empty space, lifting your shooters up. You can't stand still and space properly for everything that they want to do. Everybody around the ball has to be moving kind of in concert with each other to create these pockets of time, pockets of space where guys can attack. Because if you give a defense a static look for long enough, they're going to figure out a way to gap, you know, the driving lanes. They're going to find a way to bring two on the ball somehow if they don't like the matchups. But it's all that stuff keeps the defense moving around. And then once the guy is pulling, even if the guy is the low man, if that shooter is pulling the low man up, then you have that like 1.5 seconds to attack. And he's already looking the other way at his guy lifting up. And he's worried about that driving kick when Jaime kind of gets his double hop spin move. And then all of a sudden you're in trouble, because otherwise you get maybe a smaller mismatch stuck in the paint trying to deal with Jaime and his shoulders. And then you're like, oh my gosh, I just lost the guy up on the wing and just lifted.
Yeah, it's the Heat have done a really good job of putting that kind of strain on defenses. To that point, the Heat leading the NBA in drives for 100 possessions this year. They saw help on around 72% of their drives last year per Second Spectrum. Still one of the lower marks in the NBA. That's at like 59% this year in terms of how often they're seeing a help defender on their drives. That is easily the lowest mark in the league. So to your point, and to your point, Steve, as well, just the way that they are able to occupy defenders with their spacing, with their cutting, with some of the screening, even if it looks drastically different from last year, they have, in effect, turned this into a one-on-one game. That kind of goes back to, are they winning those? If they already look good, if not, then we have more questions. And I think as the offense has shifted as drastically as it has, like, the person that's come under the most spotlight, naturally, is Bam Adebayo, who, of, like, the duel between him and Jimmy Butler, he's the guy that's left now. Like, he is the holder of the culture at this point. He is their best player still. 19-10-3 this year. He has once again been one of the best defenders in basketball. We're going to dig into that as well. But Kuba, I'll start with you. How have you kind of seen Bam adjust to what this offense looks like this year?
Yeah, I think the first thing I like to start with Bam, especially on the offensive end, is that there's sometimes a mistake where people want to cast him as the number one offensive option just because of his status in the team and the way the roster has kind of been, you know, falling into place around him. But the team doesn't always use him that way. I think it's, you know, we talk about actions over words and expectations. He doesn't have this 30% usage rate. He's not trying to do things that, an all-NBA primary playmaker is trying to do. They do want to use him a lot in terms of isolations and finding mismatches. And one of the interesting things about this offense is that because it's so spacing and flow-based and they're not using picks, it's not always easy to find and create the mismatches that you want to create on the floor. That's something I'm kind of keeping an eye on for the playoffs when it becomes very mismatch-based basketball. And for Bam, it's created some times where even though he's not a 30% usage guy, they do need bailout offense from him. They do need shot creation. And for years, he's always been kind of the guy on the team that gets those grenade passes with 4 seconds left on the clock, do something. And this offense has sort of, you know, with less pick and roll, he's not catching the ball as much on the move. People just aren't creating for him as much as a function of this offense. It's somewhat intentional. And the roster itself also, probably one of their strengths is not, you know, advanced level playmaking. They're all very willing, unselfish passers, but there's not a lot of like pocket passes coming Bam's way. There's not a lot of skip passes where he's going to have a huge advantage. So he's creating sometimes in static situations. And we saw in December or so where there was like that 3-week stretch where his numbers were down and people were worried about, you know, slumping offense. And to me, I was watching that thinking, well, one, his jumper is just not falling. And sometimes that happens to everybody. You know, Ray Allen slumped, Duncan Robinson slumped. You're going to go through periods like that. And it didn't worry me too much. But also, his shot quality is down. Even with more threes, and he's taking more threes than ever, which this offense needs, whether or not he's playing with Khalil Ware. His shot quality on both assisted and unassisted shots is at a career low just because of what they're asking him to do. And I think, you know, to his ability, and he's gotten, even when his like efficiency numbers come down, he finds a way to improve 10% on offense every year. You know, whether it's finding a double pivot move, now he does that, like that double reverse spin move in the paint. He takes more hook shots now than ever. It's not just that little push shot, the little runner he used to do. So he's expanded his game, the offenses just changes around him, and their requirements, the necessities of what's being asked of him have also changed.
Okay, and I'm glad you said that, Coop, because my question is going to be, what's one of the bigger misconceptions about Bam as far as this season has gone? I think offensively, I don't think he gets enough credit for how decisive he has been this year as far as when he drives, how quickly he gets off of it. And I think because of how the offense has changed, it's not necessarily, okay, we have to play through Bam. Bam's going to give us a handoff. Bam's going to attack at the elbow. But he has those pockets, those moments where, okay, I catch it, I go, I'm either getting to the line, I'm getting a good shot. And if not, I'm going to kick it and we're going to continue to play. I think that's kind of been subtle ways that he's grown while this offense has changed to not say, hey, everything has to orbit around what Bam does for us. I think people got to understand, like, when he's decisive, when he's attacking and he's making these quick pockets, like we've seen hot starts from him where it's like, actually, I would like to go to the rim and you can't guard me. Well, that's a different version of Bam than we've seen before. And so I think, like, it's easy to kind of lose what he does within what the Heat offense kind of is right now, in my opinion.
Yeah, and I think it was early on when everybody was kind of getting their minds around this offense, I think still, you saw him, because they need him spacing out to the three-point line, he was getting a lot of his catches out there, but still trying to drive and attack from the three-point line out. And he's made a little bit of adjustment in the past couple of months or so, really since 2026, where they're giving him more post-touches, more catches kind of in the mid-range where, yeah, they do still need him to take threes and space out there. And when he catches there, he's just more willing to fire away. But he's not trying to attack 23 feet out. When he gets the touch from 15, 18 feet, then he's going into his attacks and getting the paint from there. And that just takes one or two dribbles away. That's less time for the defense to react to try and come to you. And it forces a more of a reaction. We've seen some teams, when he gets a lot of those early mid-post touches, they are doubling him. Like Memphis a couple weeks ago, just straight up doubled him from the first possession. They just kept doing it, doing it, doing it. And he was more than happy to swing to the opposite corner, and the Heat were just feasting on threes. But it's a little, those slight adjustments of where you know you're catching the ball, where you're more comfortable attacking from, and not just trying to brute force everything because the offense also needs you to space out.
Yeah, like I think to that point, that's where it's been fascinating. You hit on this a little bit earlier, Coop, where the Heat are now more often starting games and starting second halves with, okay, let's get a cross screen for Bam. Let's get him a touch at 16, 17 foot range. Let's let him make a decision. Like we can kind of exchange on the weak side if necessary. If they do want to send that help, then we're spraying it. We're playing advantage basketball from there. But if not, Bam, go. Get you close to the basket. Let's get you downhill. Let's get you back to the foul drawing bat that you've had since you've been a rookie, really. And I like that they've been spending, as I've talked about Bam with Steve on the pod and off air, for me, it's mostly been, can the Heat and can Bam find this kind of middle ground to where they don't need him to do everything and just be the handoff hub trademark emoji and everything runs through you and that's a big burden on him. But I don't think it can also just be, we need you around the three-point line all the time. And you're not getting those middle touches. You're not screening already. Like your on ball screens are down. Your off ball screens are down. You're not getting those reps either. And it just kind of feels like we have four or five possessions in a row where Bam's just kind of floating. And it's just like, you are still our best guy. You are still our best source of generating good offense, whether for yourself or for others. And I think over the last month or so, I'll go with you, like since 2026, it has felt like Miami has found a better blend of the spacing principles we want to get to, getting Bam involved just as a concept, and then also within that involvement, let's get you those elbow area touches, let's get you those low post touches against mismatches, let's let you get the work. So like that part has been fun for me. To the defensive side of the ball, Coop, I think we would all agree that Bam is of course elite defensively, but that he may be a bit underappreciated in non-Heat circles, in non-dunker spot circles, with everything that he is tasked with doing. Like the Heat playing as fast as they do, independent of how good the offense is or isn't, the Heat playing at this pace and being a top five defense is not an easy thing to do. And so I wanted to kind of like lay out like what do people miss with Bam Adebayo, but like why do you think this kind of disconnect exists with who Bam is, what he's asked to do, and maybe more of the league-wide acknowledgement that he gets?
I think there's a couple things to it. I mean, Bam has said this multiple times where, you know, the league does care about somewhat simple stuff like steals and blocks. he's right to a point about that. And I think you, when you look at like defensive voting for various awards, that does factor in. But I think it's about more than just the defensive stat categories, because all the advanced numbers that a lot of the voters look at, he's always been great at. Whenever he's on the floor, basically any point in the last 6-7 years, he have a top five defense. But I think it's somewhat his style of play. He's not Kevin Garnett, like yelling all the time, in your face kind of a defender. And he's also very, very, and I mean this in a complimentary way, he's very stable, where he doesn't fly around looking for blocks. He's so good at moving his feet while having his hands high, you know, and moving and keeping his hands high and being wide. He's like almost a prototypical textbook. When you're teaching kids how to defensive slide, bam is what you want them to be doing. And he does it without fouling. But without fouling, because he's also not swiping at the ball. He's not trying to be as much of a defensive playmaker all the time, because I think in part he knows the team needs him to just be solid. So when they're playing Brooklyn last night and he picks up two fouls and he has his fifth foul in the third quarter, I almost about fell on my chair, because that never, ever happens. Bam is never in foul trouble. But I agree. Every year, I probably have spilled more ink talking about Bam's defense than most people on the planet. I just think he is an unbelievable defender. I think he's one of the best defenders of his generation. After, I know him and Draymond Green, especially, are probably, maybe Draymond's a little ahead for what he was at his peak, but they're 1A and 1B as far as the best switch defenders of the past 15 years. And switching bigs unlock an entirely new dimension to your defense if you have the right personnel around it. The Heat haven't always had the right personnel. When back in 21-22, when they were the number one seed in the East, they had P.J. Tucker, who was one of the best role players the team has ever had, you know, in 20 years. And he was a perfect, perfect complement, along with Kyle Lowry. Kyle Lowry enabled some of this too, but for them to switch 1-5, as the roster changed, Bam had to completely change up his entire defensive coverage. All of a sudden, he's playing drop coverage most of the time. I just don't think he got enough credit. And credit is, you know, in media world, credit is whatever it is. I just think it wasn't built up as a big enough story in terms of what he is as a defender, that he's all of a sudden playing a defensive coverage that wasn't playing to his strengths at all. And now they're back to switching. They are playing a lot of zone. A lot of that's with Kalel, when Bam and Kalel on the floor, especially in the past few weeks, like 50% of the possessions have been in zone. But it just doesn't matter what you put Bam in. He's going to put a top five defense on the floor as long as he's there. And he does it with communication. He does it with leadership. He does it with unbelievable athletic ability. And you just see it in the respect that teams give him. They want to get him switched onto someone else, and they want to put him in the corner and get him away from the ball. And that's one of the biggest signs of respect a team could ever give a defender. And one of my favorite things on that note, and I'll end it there, is that Devin Booker over the years has been the kind of the A number one guy for this. Devin Booker will just get Bam on a switch, and then he'll go stand at like half court and just say, y'all play 4-on-4. You know? I did my job. I got Bam out of the play. Y'all go play 4-on-4 and figure it out. And sometimes that was the right move, because it just gets Bam away from the ball. So I think defenses, coaches around the league show you what they think of Bam as a defender and how they run their offense. And it just takes fans a little bit of time to catch up, because he's not a highlight guy in the way that some other guys are.
Yeah, I was going to say, real quick, me and the guys have joked about that. It's, hey, Bam, good to see you. You go stand over there. We're going to play offense everywhere but where you're at. But I think to Coop's point, there's a volume that people can see defensively. And I don't know if Bam's always registers, but if you're looking at him every single night, he nails every rotation. He nails all of his coverages. He does his job. He lifts his team up, and he's asked to do a ton on ball and off ball to make sure that he defense operates at a high level. And I think that's where you have to have an appreciation for it. Like, it's going to be hard for someone to turn on a Heat game and see Bam space in the corner. A team does a cut from the wing, and Bam just very quickly says, I'll take this cut and switch. And now, without anything else, the Heat defense is recovered. You don't notice those type of things all the time. You know, I think, you know, switching can get, can be noticeable, but then if it's like, okay, we don't actually want to attack Bam, okay, well then you're not going to notice his rotations or his efforts on the weak side or his communication. So I think it's more of a volume deal with Bam more than anything else. Go ahead, Nikos.
Oh, no, I was just going to kind of supplement now what both of you have kind of said. This year, the Miami Heat defending at a top three level with Bam on the floor. And when he goes to the bench, their defensive rating is equivalent to around 16th. I think that's where Dallas is right now, which not quite the slide for Dallas if they've been in the top 10 for most of the year. But either way, that kind of shows you Bam is here. We do. When he is not, we can be fine, but we don't turn into the elite defensive team that we ultimately are overall. You see that with the half court defense is elite with him on the floor. And I think quieter, and it kind of circles to your switch point. I think for the pro Heat, pro Bam folks that want to make the defensive player of the year case louder for Bam, I think highlighting the fact, and Coop, you've done this a ton with your writing over the years, the fact that the Heat operate as like one of, if not the best defensive rebounding team in basketball when Bam's on the floor, and they just cannot end possessions whatsoever when he goes to the bench. It's like a very under-discussed portion of Bam's overall impact with Miami's defense this year and overall. And I think once you also tie in the fact that they play zone at a higher rate than anybody in the NBA, they did so last year, they're doing so this year. They switch pretty much, like, switch more than I think everyone except Brooklyn this year, funny enough, coming off those two games against the Nets. High switch rate, high zone rate, they end possessions at an elite rate with Bam on the floor still, regardless of them kind of shifting their coverages to that degree. That's not an easy needle to thread. And I think Bam deserves more credit for that. He's been phenomenal again this year. Like, you shouldn't play this fast. And then once you also factor in like who they've had the point of attack at times, all the injuries that they've had to deal with in their guard and wing room, the fact that they're like firmly a top five defense right now should speak very loudly to what Bam has meant to this group this year. So I wanted to make sure that Bam got his love there and wanted to talk about the defense there. I guess to kind of close out that portion, like, how real do you think his award exploits are this year, Coop? Like, does he have an all NBA case on top of like a DPOY case?
Well, he does, and I've been putting these numbers out the past week. He does have one of the best on-off point differentials and just net rating differentials in the entire league. Like, he's below Jokic and Wemby. He's just above Shea. So as far as impact, I think he does have an all-NBA case. I totally understand that the way all of this works and people, you know, look at the offensive volume and numbers and everything, and that things don't always line up. So whether or not he gets all-NBA or not, I think he will get votes this year just because the Heat have been as good as they have been on defense. DPOY, I get what it is with Wemby. I think Wemby is one of the most unique, possibly best defenders we've ever seen. And there is this sense that, you know, as long as Wemby is eligible for the award, people gravitate towards him. I just want to make sure Bam gets enough of a look, because even if he's not going to win DPOY, which I do think he is a strong candidate for, and to your point, Nikias, people always have for years talked about the Heat's rebounding, and they have just simply not understood that the Heat are an elite rebounding team when Bam is on the floor. This year, he has the single highest defensive rebounding percentage differential in the entire league of anybody. Mm-hmm. Nobody has impacted defensive rebounding more than Bam in the league this year. But even whether or not he wins DPOY, whether or not, you know, everybody loves Wemby, and I'm not, Wemby is great, obviously. Last year he missed all defensive, and that shouldn't happen. Bam is an all defensive level player every single year. Whether or not he wins the top award or not, I think he needs to be on one of those two teams, because he is just that good, that generational of a defender.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. Steve, do you have any quick thoughts on the Bam award cases this year before we move?
Nah, Coop laid it out very well.
There we go. Shout out to Khalil Ware for the perfect timing of having the game that he had right before we recorded the Heat podcast. Because what do you mean, coming off the bench, and to your earlier point, Coop, Bam, very rare foul trouble, checks out with five fouls with, I think, 6:56 left in the third quarter. And Khalil Ware plays, I think, like 14 and a half minutes straight, which that in and of itself is kind of insane for a big, especially a young one. But 16 and 11, which is good enough off the bench, Heat, I think, plus 18 in this minutes. 12 stops for Khalil Ware in this basketball game. 5 steals, 7 blocks, with a goaltend that was challenged and ultimately wasn't overturned. Another, like, block shot, but a shooting foul was called on it. So, like, it could have been 9. I think Spo referenced that in the post-game presser as well. So, great timing for him. But Khalil Ware has been one of the more polarizing like second year players in the league this year. I think that's fair to say. On the high end, he can change games on both ends of the floor. Catch lobs, knock down three, swat shots, end possessions. And on the low end, we have seen Spo not be pleased with some of the effort defensively and some of the screening and some of the shot versus pass decisions. And we see like, huh, he played 10 minutes tonight. That's kind of interesting. He had that stint in the first half. We didn't see him anymore. That's interesting. So I guess for you, Coop, like what strides have you seen from Khalil Ware in year two compared to year one? And I guess, what do you think his upside ultimately is?
Yeah, I think there's Khalil as a player, and then there's the conversation about Khalil, and those things can mm-hmm. often not be matched up very well. And I understand why that happens, because you see someone with his physical abilities and with his length and how easy he makes some things look. And I think from a fan perspective, you can sometimes see a player like that and think he's closer to a finished product than he really is. And that's fine. And I get why that happens, but we also need to let him develop. And he's still a developing player. He's still learning a lot. Last year, you know, Spo always uses the phrase, rookies are learning through a fire hose. There's a lot of stuff. Learning defensive coverages as a center is incredibly complex and complicated in the league today. But he's become more solid. And I think it's, you know, Spo has shown you that the minutes have gone up, the minutes have gone down a little bit. It's fluctuated, but he's come back to it. He's come back to trying to get Bam and him on the floor at the same time. And I think part of that is just because if Khalil is just playing as Bam's backup, it's hard to get him more than 15 or so minutes a game. Now that you're playing them together, it's easy to get Khalil's minutes up. It's easy to reward him with more minutes when he's having a game like he did in Brooklyn, when he had the first 10-10-5-5 game in franchise history, first 10-10-5-5 game off the bench in NBA history, right? And I asked Spo after the game last night, because 50% of Khalil's half-court defensive possessions since All-Star have been in zone, whether or not he's with Bam or not. There's been a ton of zone. And Spo's answer as to why he's been gravitating more towards that coverage for him is simply that it kind of simplifies the floor for him. There's a little bit less to read. He can see the ball in front of him all the time. He can use his length to just devour the paint. And you've seen it some of these mm-hmm. steals where, you know, Brooklyn, and again, Brooklyn is not one of the league's elite offenses, but they're trying to skip the ball over the paint. And Khalil just reaches his hand up and you can't get past him, right? And that ability to just keep him there and not have to worry him. He doesn't have to worry about playing up on a screen, playing up to the level, stopping a pull-up shooter or anything like that. He just has to worry about the paint and rebounding, where that's probably the single greatest stride he's taken this year, as being a consistent, solid rebounder on both ends, especially on the offensive glass, where he can high point a ball where maybe only five other guys in the league can get that ball. So mm-hmm. he's become much more solid, and there just is some development that needs to happen, and that's normal for a young guy. We just shouldn't treat them as finished products yet. And when a coach is showing you through their usage of a guy what they need to work on, we need to listen to what the coach is saying, whether he's using, you know, with how he's working his rotations. But, you know, a game like that is really nice to see for Khalil, because one of my favorite things about him, and I'll end with this, is just that he responds to coaching. I think they're pretty hard on him. Bam is on him. UD is on him. You know, he's sending texts from the Prime studio. You know, everybody wants him to succeed. And every time you hear about some of that publicly, he responds. He'll come in with great energy. He'll come in. He'll dominate the glass. He'll protect the paint. He does what he needs to do. So you just see these steps, these strides, and it's just about stacking good days and Spo's words and getting a little bit better. Because where he is now versus where I think he'll be in a couple of years, where he can be, there's still a huge way to go, which just speaks to how much better he can get versus what he is right now.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. Just quickly, and I have a question for you, Steve, on the Ware front. Like, one of my favorite mini games from that Nets Heat game from Thursday night in particular was the Heat getting into zone. And like, Jordy, I'm a big fan of Jordy in Brooklyn. But either way, it's just like, hey, we're going to find a way to use MPJ as a weapon to break this zone. We're going to start him on the right wing. We're going to have someone clear from the left wing. We're then going to relocate MPJ to the opposite corner because we know you want to have Khalil Ware there. Let's see how you navigate that. And like, it wasn't always perfect on Miami's end, but like, watching them kind of navigate that, watch Khalil Ware, which I think, to your point, part of being in the zone, like, he sees everything ahead of him. Like, it forces him to be a communicator. he has to be able to call things out from the back line. I think he's gotten better with that as the team's gone, as the year's gone on as well. But like, just kind of watching that kind of mini battle was a fun one for me. And so, Steve, for you with the Ware front, I have the same general, like, what have you seen from him this year compared to last year? But as you are so good at nosing defense in particular, I want to get your thoughts on, like, where are you at with Khalil Ware as a defender overall?
I think for Khalil Ware, it's about consistently doing your job on the defensive end. I think the growth that you've seen at times from him comes from the timing. You know, a lot of zone helps him out, but I think even some of the man possessions, it's okay. If my man catches on the perimeter at the elbow and there's a drive, am I over helping? Am I timing my help right? Am I getting back out to a closeout? Am I helping our team with my help, or am I putting us in a tough spot? If it's pick and roll, okay, are they putting me on the move? Am I in position to be close to level or in drop? Am I getting hit by the roll? Am I able to contest? It's just kind of nailing the little things. I think his best nights come when he's just solid defensively and just does his job. I'm going to hit this. I'm going to hit Y. I get out, we're good to go. And then that's a tough thing for a young player to do. I think people kind of underrate how hard it is to necessarily do your job every single time because of what you're asked to do. You know, you have to navigate space and time and pace, and okay, there's a reject. Now do I overhelp here? If I overhelp, that's going to open up the role. Do I get back? Do I contest? And so I think for me, with Khalil, it's just been continued growth as a young player and a young big in a league that wants to put those kind of players in action. Hey, you're tall, you're athletic. Would you like to defend multiple things at once? Would you like to be on the space on the perimeter and try and help and do your job from a different area of the court? And so I think it's kind of a give and take. And I think that's something we can kind of forget when it comes to players developing. Once you kind of see the ceiling, it's like, oh, that person's that. And it's like, yes, but if you show me that, I'm going to try and take that away. There's a whole other team saying, okay, cool. If you're going to do this, then let's do that. And now I have to adjust to that. So it's a back and forth, I think. But I think for me, it's more about just having a consistent effort and having a consistency and doing the job. And okay, I know what I'm going to get. That's one of the tougher things for a young player to kind of master, especially in today's NBA.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Like, I think for me, just kind of tracking the defense, like, one of the questions I wanted to bring to both of you, but y'all have already answered it at this point. But like, I was just kind of wondering, like, what is the ideal Khalil Ware coverage right now? Because Coop has brought up, like, they have been in zone a ton. And I think simplifying things for him, forcing him to communicate more, keeping him near the basket, I think is fruitful. Watching an ungodly amount of drop reps from Khalil between yesterday and this morning, it's like he has the length. The shot challenger can be good. I think conceptually, the way that he is now trying to bake in more of, I am backpedaling, I'm also kind of stabbing at the ball and trying to play that middle ground. Like, I like they're trying to do more of those things. But like, the balance when backpedaling can be a little bit inconsistent, like the load ups when he is trying to contest, when trying to get backwards and trying to contest those lobs, like Nick Claxton got him with one in the second quarter and I ended up clipping it and was like, sometimes I just sigh watching him and drop, not because he like can't do it, but because like some of these are so loud. It's like, man, if he gets this, he's going to be insane. But I just kind of want him to get this type beat. But like, I think it's there for him ultimately. And as he continues to stack things, this is where you get into a real or heightened level of scheme versatility, especially when you're talking about him and Bam playing together, which to that end, that has also been one of the louder conversations around the Khalil Ware experience since he's been drafted. When Miami brought him in, just like, okay, cool, you're drafting a center that has a whole lot of upside. We have Bam Adebayo, who is like an all-NBA caliber guy. Do you really project those two guys playing together? Which kind of took me to mind, like, okay, is Bam going to actually become a three-point shooter? Because like, last year, like second half of last season, he's like shooting 37, 38% for three. And it's like, oh, well, this is real. This is cool, but we need to see if it's going to be real. Khalil Ware this year, shooting 40% from three, that's dope. You look at what the splits have been for him so far this year, 47% from three before the turn of the calendar. He's at 32% since the turn of the calendar. And I was like, okay, I don't really know what to do with this. Steve, you'll probably chuckle at this one. It kind of reminds me of how I felt about Alanna Smith offensively to a degree, where it's just like, if the three ball is a part of the package, in addition to like the passing, the screening, et cetera, this is an all-star fringe, all WNBA player. If she's not that, she can still be impactful offensively, but it does limit the ceiling. And then as you get into the playoffs, okay, teams are just going to help off of her. And so my bigger question about that pairing was less defense, because I think Bam plus Ware, even as he's trying to learn how to become a consistent defender, pretty high floor and a very high ceiling with those two in the front court. Offensively, I've always kind of wondered, can either one of those guys spread the floor enough or at least provide plus value for the perimeter? And I think that's where the Bam playmaking ability helps. But like, can they get there offensively? This year, nearly a 120 offensive rating with Bam and Khalil Ware on the floor together per PvP stats. It's a plus 9.1 net rating in 350 minutes together. So I guess, Coop, I'll ask you, like, what is your confidence level now in that pairing as we get closer to play-in slash playoff time and just kind of zooming out? Can this just be the front court of the future for Miami?
Well, I think generally speaking, yes, it can be the front court of the future. But speaking to now and the next month or so, I don't really know yet, simply because the numbers have been so drastic. I mean, early in their season, before when Spo went away from it, it was because, you know, the defense was slipping a little bit, getting a little unlucky with that pair in terms of opponent three-point shooting. But the offense was, you know, as it was the year before, it was a little clunky. And then it's been such a dramatic shift over the past 3 or 4 weeks. But it's also come against, you know, some teams that maybe don't have the strongest defensive looks. So it's a little hard to say what's real or not as far as the numbers go themselves. But I do think Ware is real as a three-point shooter. Whether the volume is there to make defenses respect him and space out, you know, as his true five-out kind of center, I think we'll have to see. We'll just have to see them play more high-level defenses. I really want to see what a playoff scheme would look against the two of them, because that's really going to be, you know, the tail of the tape as far as learning about them and how a defense reacts to them over like 5, 6, 7 games. If he can get there, they got to get, you know, do some work before then. But what's interesting is just that, like you said, the offense needs them spacing out. So it's not, we talk about double big looks, but this is not like, you know, Steve's group back in the day with Zebo and Marc Gasol. The Heat don't have high, low, elbow, dunker spot spacing. These guys aren't really interacting with each other a ton on offense. They don't have a ton of passes going each other's way. So it really does just become about that spacing. I think it helps that Bam has become such a willing volume guy, and he takes step back sometimes now. There's zero hesitation. The release has gotten quicker, which helps. But sometimes it just comes down to make or miss. And all the in-between stuff, I personally just want to see against a higher level, you know, defense, which we're going to start seeing from the Heat, you know, in the next couple of weeks. So they've got Charlotte games, Detroit games, Orlando games, Houston again. There's a lot more tests coming in the next few weeks that we're going to learn more about this pairing as we see more of it.
Gosh. A question I wanted to ask, I guess less player specific, but as you brought up the zone with Khalil and Bam on the floor in particular, I guess I just had a general question about Miami's zone and their usage. It's down from last year in terms of the percentage of possessions that they go into zone, but it is still tops in the league. And the conversation that Steve and I have kind of had throughout the years with Miami zone is like, one, how unique it is and how they go like high ball pressure into the different zone looks, the way that they're able to pass off assignments. And so like the actual structure is interesting to me. But the bigger picture conversation we've had is when Miami decides we are going to go zone, how often they're going zone from a position of strength or just because this is the line we want to play versus we are kind of getting cooked in our base coverage right now. We need to change this up. We need to make this offensive team think right now. Do you feel like Miami has kind of found the ideal blend between whatever their man concepts are, switching, drop, whatever, and getting to like this volume of zone?
I think they're getting there. I don't know if we're going to know for sure until, because again, we really haven't seen the full rotation healthy all year long. Every time Tyler comes back, Norm is out. Every time Norm is playing, Tyler's been out. And how that alignment goes as far as setting up a perimeter defense is going to inform a lot, I think, of what coverages they go to. But, you know, what the structure of the zone is one thing, and Spo will move guys around almost every game. Davion the other day was like, all of a sudden I'm playing on the wing. I've never played on the wing of the zone. I've always been up top. But that's just the way they needed him to play. And again, it's not just the zone. You guys know this. It's a press zone. So they are pressing full court and then dropping back into the zone. So they're already killing an extra couple of seconds off the clock. And then the team is coming up being like, okay, what do we do? And by the time they even get into like a zone offense action, sometimes there's like 9 seconds on the clock. So that's kind of half the battle there. But you know, what has always impressed me the most about Spo with the zone is how fluidly they toggle between the two. if you're going zone every possession down the floor and the defense knows what to expect, that's one thing. And the really, really great offenses, especially those that can shoot and beat you over the top, they're going to beat you eventually. They're going to find a way. But what Spo does so well, and I think it's a huge compliment to the preparation of the team and how much they work this behind the scenes, is, you know, coming down, here's our man-to-man coverage. Next time down, we're playing off a make. We scored, playing off a free throw, we're dropping back into the press zone. And sometimes it can be 1-2, 1-2, 1-2, constantly for like eight straight possessions. That is not an easy thing to do, and I do not want to underplay, you know, what that does in terms of changing up your pitch mix, so to speak. You know, fast up, change up, curveball in that way, and not giving the other teams the same look constantly. It has been increased usage lately, I think in part because that's been good for Kalel. It's been good for Bam and Kalel together. Again, we'll just have to see what it's like again the next few weeks when the schedule kind of picks up.
Yeah, the Houston game felt very instructive on that point. Go ahead, Steve.
Well, I was just going to say, the Houston game where they decided, you know what, we're going to put someone in the middle. We're going to put a toothpick in our mouth. And someone started in the middle. And then there's two passing, it's right back to the same zone. I was like, ha, well done, Spo. That's good, Miami. But I think overall, having the versatility to be able to time when they use it, to be able to tie in, hey, we're also staying matched up within this zone, to kind of be disruptive to offenses to where it's a position of strength. I think that's always been when the Miami Heat have been at their best defensively, is when that zone is just something that, okay, it's not necessarily just to get you out of rhythm. It's not necessarily just to slow you down on the shot clock. It's also, hey, you don't necessarily know what we're going to do. You don't necessarily know where you're going to attack. We've taken you out of something, and now you have to figure it out. And so them being able to have that in their back pocket is always when they're at their best. But yeah, that middleman thing got me. They're always going to find a different way to kind of just, hey, we're in zone, but are we? Ha ha.
And even then, in that Houston game, to that point, you know, they used it strategically against the Houston lineups when KD was off the floor, and Houston did not have a lot of shooters on the floor, so that those half court possessions were mucked up like crazy. There was very little spacing going on, and that, you know, you play to who's on the other side of the floor from you, and Spo knows, hey, I see a weakness in that lineup. Let's go to the best coverage for it.
Yeah, Alperen Şengün did not have a good time dealing with that zone and the pickups in the middle of the floor there. Okay, one more player I wanted to get into, and then we can get into a little bit of rapid fire. So Tyler Hero is back, as you alluded to, Coop. Norm's here. Hero's here. Norm isn't. We're currently dealing with the Hero stretch without Norm Powell, who hopefully is going to be back somewhat soon. But as of recording, 21.3 points per game, 58% on twos for Tyler Hero right now, 36 from three, 92 from the line, four boards, three assists in 18 games so far. I wanted to ask you about the inside the arc scoring in particular. I think the great young Brady Hawk recently asked Spo about the floater in particular for Tyler Hero, and I have some stats on that front. But it does look like Tyler just feels a lot more comfortable as he's gotten more games under his belt, the minutes are rising, but he just feels more comfortable operating inside the arc. And I feel like that's kind of been the big thing to all the star potential talk with him. Like, can he get to a point to where he's pressuring the rim enough to really bend defense? And so, like, what have you kind of seen from Tyler inside the arc over this last stretch of games?
Well, you have to look at it within the context of the offense they're running too, because, you know, Tyler's been a pick and roll player for most of his career until he comes in this year and all of a sudden, hey, we're not doing that anymore. And when he came back, I think the second time, you know, in January for a handful of games, the pick and roll usage did start to tick up a little bit with Tyler, more screens with Bam. And it was just, let's find a way to create an advantage for him. But like, to your point, these last few games, now that he's been back, it's been, the pick and roll usage has come up a little bit, but not to the point that it was up before. And he's finding ways. He plays off, everybody respects him as a shooter. He's playing off closeouts. The team gets him in space. His handle has improved significantly over the past few years, where he's excellent at rejecting screens when running pick and roll, but he's also great, you know, hitting with an inside out dribble, you know, crossing over, getting a guy on his hip, getting guys in jail. And he's unbelievably comfortable now, to your point, playing through physicality. You know, he can get to that floater. He's off 2 feet. He's off his strong leg. He's off his right foot. You know, he can get to it whichever way. It doesn't matter. As long as he gets a little bit of airspace, he's getting that perfect release. He's got great touch inside the paint. And it's become a huge weapon, because if you can make those short shots, those like 8-foot shots, at the rate that other guys convert layups, then you are basically in effect, applying rim pressure to the efficiency point, even if you're not actually getting to the rim. And as a helpful part of that, you're also not one of those guys who's diving in, getting to his takeoff zone, trying to take a crazy layup that maybe you're good at making, but you're always going to fall down. And if you miss it, then you're going 4-on-5 the other way. Now, if you're taking the 8-foot shot and you're making it at the same rate, your defense is more solid. You're able to get back and still play 5-on-5.
Yeah, like I think to that point, like the play strength and the handle improving makes it a little bit easier for him to kind of live with that particular shot diet. Like him getting into, like Steve chuckles when I bring up like deceleration and things like that. But he had a few in the Nets game on Thursday where it's just like, I am absorbing a blow. It's a slow step. I can still get to this flick. You can't really do anything about it. And he's still hitting it at this clip, which to that point, as of recording right now, and like the tracking for like what's a floater versus what's a long layup, et cetera, like insert grain of salt here if you want, but from Second Spectrum. Tyler Hero, 41 of 65 on floaters this year, which is a 63% conversion rate. That is the best among 69 players that have attempted at least 50 so far. And he is outperforming his expected efficiency Second Spectrum tracks, like based on where the player is, who the defender is, how strong the contest is, et cetera, like what the expected efficiency is supposed to be. Tyler's outperforming his number by over 20 percentage points right now. He should not be doing this. To your point, Coop, about, hey, it may be a tough shot overall, but you are comfortable making these. If this is the level that he's at, it does just kind of add another layer. In addition to, as you mentioned with Norm, like we can sprinkle in some of the more designed off-ball stuff. We can uptick the pick and rolls, particularly in fourth quarters. This is something that you, Steve, have talked about, and I'll toss it to you. Overall, Coop kind of hit on like what Miami's doing, but how have you kind of felt about the way that Miami has tried to balance their overall spacing principles and their driving principles with making sure Tyler has, you know, still getting a few ball screens to kind of get him going, particularly when he gets into like late clock situations or late game situations?
Well, I mean, you know, there's always going to be pick and roll. That was always the thing I fought against. It's like, hey, I know they're not running a lot of ball screens, but they're going to eventually. It's going to be mixed in for Norm, for Tyler Hero. We're going to mix them in and put pressure on teams depending on what we have. I think the one thing for Tyler is his adaption, as you guys mentioned, with the floater, it's the fluidity in that, okay, if you're pressuring me, I can now make quicker decisions because if I don't necessarily have a drive all the way to the basket, I still know I can get it to a shot. If I don't have anything, I can get off of it. I know I can get it back. And so I think it's helped his overall rhythm as opposed to, okay, I need to set this up so I can supercharge my drive so I can get to the basket. So now I can take the contact or I can get to a step back or a pull up. No, I can now kind of lead the dance a little bit more with my ability to kind of create and get to, okay, you don't know if it's going to be a step back, a pull up or a floater, but I'm doing the same handle. And now you have to defend me in a different way. But I think pick and roll overall, it's going to be something that they're not going to lean on or rely on, but it'll be in there. You'll always see it. I think it's a credit to their offense that they can play so random, but it's going to happen. They push the ball up and Bam's just like, you know what? I'm here. I'll set one for you, Tyler. It's fine.
I got you. I'll quickly add on the Tyler front, averaging about 15 drives per 100 possessions so far this year. That would be one of the lowest marks of his career, but again, only 18 games in. The Heat are generating over 1.2 points per possession on any trip featuring a Tyler Hero drive right now. That is easily the highest mark of his career, and that is third among 250 players that have logged at least 100 drives so far. The two players ahead of Tyler Hero on that point, Giannis, which makes sense because he's freaking Giannis and one of the most dominant rim players we have ever seen, and Tim Hardaway Jr., who sneaks in with 104 drives, so barely hits the threshold of 100. A whole lot of closeout attacks in Denver, playing off of the Jokic gravity, et cetera. But like that was a funny one for me. But it does, again, speak to like Tyler has been very, very good getting downhill so far. Now I want to go a little rapid fire with you, Coop, as we get through. I want to ask you about some guys, and I ultimately want to get into a lineup question or two with you. But first, while we're on like the all-star / former all-star kick, this has been a solid season for Andrew Wiggins, I would say. I think on the high end, you see the two-way impact for him. Post-ups, drives, knocks down threes, and then can defend a little bit of everyone. It's like, cool. On other nights, it feels like, hey, did Andrew Wiggins, did he have like 5 touches tonight? Like, why has this felt so quiet for him? I guess just in general, how have you kind of felt about the Andrew Wiggins season and more particular, like his offensive usage within this context?
Yeah, I mean, I think, like you guys, we've lived with Andrew Wiggins as a featured part of this league for a long time. I think we're pretty familiar with who he is. And so coming in, I had an expectation, let's see Wiggs be Wiggs, and he has been. That's exactly what he's been exactly as advertised in most of the best ways. I mean, he's, like you said, incredibly solid on defense. He's one of the three best defenders. He enables a lot of the switching that they want to do now. And I think to that consistency point, it's not just a consistent production level. It's consistent, you know, the way he gets the same shots every game. It's like an elbow pull-up jumper. It's a drive from the wing. It's a post-up into a hook shot against a smaller guy. It's the quick trigger, you know, three-pointer. Obviously incredible in transition. He really helps fuel their pace. He's just so solid every game, and I don't ever really get – I almost never look at Wiggins' numbers at the end of a game, what he scored, anything like that, because he's just kind of the same guy. It's just the game, the context around him changes, the matchup changes, the rotation changes, because his usage rate will come down when the team is completely healthy. Or there's some games where he has a great matchup and you just want to go to it. Boom, 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 boom. Make them stop you or make the defense adjust. He's a hugely, hugely versatile player. And I commend him because I think the way he approaches the game is the way pretty much everybody in the league should.
They've needed an athlete like that and just that wing 6'7", 6'8". Archetype in the room for quite some time. So like Andrew Wiggins being able to field that has been important. I think about the Wiggins experience overall. I've always kind of wondered like, hey, he's super athletic. He can fly around. Like one, why is the defense consistency kind of been what it's been before we get to like the Golden State era and stuff? Like, why is this not more consistent? And also like, why is this dude averaging like 4 or 5 rebounds a game? Like this feels weird. You saw the uptick in Golden State. Something that I really enjoyed within this Heat season for him. He's been flying in for these offensive rebounds every night. Like teams just do not know what to do when he is in the corner, shot goes up, he's flying around, he's spaced around the wing, you don't see him coming, and now it's like either put back dunk attempt or he's just skying and then grabbing one pump fake and gets to the line. It's like, okay, these are the kind of little things that you want to see for Andrew Wiggins that he's been capable of doing forever, that you saw him literally do during a title run. And so it's been cool that Miami's been able to get that version as well. As we cycle through some of the younger players, with Pelle Larsson, what I literally have in the dot to peel the curtain back for the folks listening or watching the pod, I literally have, what is this as a question? Because like where he had flashes last year as I will defend, I will get into your face, I will cut, I'll knock down corner three sometimes, and I was going to be glue in this lineup. The minutes have gone up. The responsibility has gone up. The freedom has gone up as Miami allows everyone to drive. And like the drives from him, like I just didn't think it was going to look like this, where he's like shoulder checking people on some of these. He's getting into like some Euros on some of these extension finishes for him. What do you make of the Pelle Larsson experience this year? Because he's become a very important piece to what Miami does.
Pelle's awesome. I think it took like 2 games in his first summer league where I looked at him. I was like, yeah, that guy's going to be in the league for the next 15 years. he passes every kind of eye test in the way he plays, the way he approaches. And I'll tell you a quick story about him. You know, last year he had this great play in his rookie year where he like dove on the floor 3 times, eventually saved it for a 3-point shot. It got a huge crowd pop. And I asked him about it after the game and he was almost mad at himself because he was like, you know, 2 games ago, I didn't dive for the ball and I wasn't going to let that happen again. And that's just the way he thinks. Every time I talk to him, he's like, yeah, I think about that a lot. I think about my drives. I think about the way I'm setting my shots. He's always thinking about the game. He's always kind of processing the way he's playing, the way he can get better. He's unbelievably tough. He puts his face into everything. He's constantly getting hit in the face. I'm sure you guys know about that whole thing.
Yes.
He's an unbelievably tough guy. He's very, very, very strong. When he gets a guy on his shoulder in the paint, they can't do anything about it. His finishing is developing. I think he's taken many steps forward in terms of being the paint finisher, using the glass, finishing through contact and everything like that. But really the only piece that has been up and down is the shooting. And you see some teams still put centers on him. They'll put centers on Hyman. They'll try and crowd the paint. And with Houston the other day, that was what he did so well. He just started setting screens. He started cutting. And he also just looked at Şengün and said, I'm going right at you. And he put Şengün on the deck a couple times. I think he scored through him going right into his chest like 4 times in that game. So Pelle is a complete package role player. He has sold himself as a role player since the day, even before he got drafted. That's who he's put himself out there, advertised himself to be. And he's been everything that he said he would be as a role player. I think he's going to have a very, very long career. And I think as he gets experience in the playoffs, he's going to become one of those you know, not a star household name, but one of those role players that every fan in the league eventually knows their name, that kind of a guy.
He just feels very set up. Like if the Heat, either they stay in the play-in or make the playoffs, if the Heat like win a playoff round or make a random Eastern Conference Finals run this year, there's going to be like a three game stretch where you mentioned the shot. And I think he's in the low 30s right now in terms of 3-point percentage, where he's going to do all of the energy stuff defensively. And he's going to dive on the floor and there's going to be like a chest to chest interaction with the star. And then he's going to go like 5 of 8 from three in a game. And the opposing fan base is going to be like, why is the Caleb Martin thing happening again? What on earth is this? Yeah. Who is that guy? It just sets up for that. But like, he's been incredibly fun. Steve, I'm going to toss you a question. This super bad to Coop. We've talked quite a bit about High Bay Hawkins Jr. this year. As of recording, 15-5-5 right now, primarily in the bench role, seems to be towards the top of the list in the sixth man of the year conversation. How do you feel about his candidacy now versus the beginning of the year? Just in general, how have you felt about the season from him this year?
I think it's still strong. I mean, I think when you were talking about Miami's offense and the ability to drive and to win matchups, Jaime Jaquez has still been really important and key to that. Maybe it's not as loud as it was early in the season, but when he is able to get downhill, win matchups, get in the paint, make plays, make defenses go ahead and show help, and now he's able to open up other plays, that's really important for Miami. You know, him and Davion Mitchell, when they do that, it feels different. And so I think for me, Jaime should be on the list, but he's had a really solid season as far as consistent growth and understanding, really have just the confidence of what I'm going to do when I get downhill, the ability to consistently be physical and just have a kind of a swagger and demeanor as far as it's not just going to be, you know, a step back, a fadeaway, I'm going to hit you and you got to deal with me in a different way. And a lot of teams haven't enjoyed that experience for the most part. So I'm still impressed by what he's done this year.
Yeah, true. Cool. I want to ask you the same question about a sixth man of the year candidacy. But first, I kind of want to zoom out because Jaime is coming off of an up and down year from last season. And so for him to kind of bounce back to be in the thick of this race and ultimately be one of Miami's most effective slash consistent guys this year, were you expecting this level of bounce back for him? Or should we have seen this season coming from him?
I really wasn't sure. I think you guys probably say this all the time, but we all know that development isn't linear. So if a guy has a down sophomore year, we should not assume that it's going to stay that way. And in the same way, just because a guy has a great rookie year, you don't always assume he's going to have a great second year. The league adjusts to you. You have to constantly find counters and adjust. And once I figured out what this offense is going to look like through training camp, preseason, the first couple weeks of the season, I quickly began to realize that Jaime was going to be one of the greatest beneficiaries of what this offense is, just because of his skill set to get downhill, because of how physical and rugged he can be and how well he can finish through contact. What he's brought up a lot of times this year is playing off 2 feet. And at first, when I took that, I was like, okay, you're just doing less of what I said before. You're less of getting into your 1 foot launching pad and going in trying to finish in the trees. But it's also playing off 2 feet and keeping your dribble alive. And I think those two things go hand in hand because, you know, his rookie year, I was not the same kind of player, but in the back of my head, I was a little bit thinking of Tyreek Evans back in the day. And if you remember, Tyreek Evans had that great rookie year. A lot of it was off that spin move. It was power spin in the lane, power spin in the lane. And the league kind of adjusted to it. They started taking that spin away. And, you know, he had injuries and his career went a different direction. But with Jaime, I was like, okay, what's going to happen once the league adjusts to his spin move, adjusts to his footwork? And what happens is now he's not trying to go for the full spin anymore. And that's part of where keeping your dribble alive, it's like a spin, but he's keeping it's a 2 foot spinning jump stop. And then he's still dribbling. And instead of spinning, he's more like twisting his way back and forth and kind of burrowing his way into the lane, keeping the dribble alive while also with his back to the basket, he now sees all the shooters around him for the driving kick. So this offense has really simplified the game for him in terms of his reads and what he needs to do, but he's also elevated his counter to the league's adjustment by playing out 2 feet and just staying alive and being an active playmaker as well to complement his scoring.
Yeah, I think to your point about him really sliding into this, it's very funny to look at the isolation list right now. And the top 10 is just like all-star, all-NBA, future Hall of Fame guys, 1 through 9, and then 10th in terms of total isolations run. Then it's Jaime. It's just like, well, that's a level of freedom that I did not expect heading into the year. But to your point, he's gotten so good at it. And I think the spacing certainly helps for him. And like, there aren't many guys that he's not going to get your number one defender more nights than not. So like, you have small guards sometimes cross-matching against him in transition. And he's just like, yeah, I am bullying you, little bro. Like, I'm sorry. You were coming with me. You're going to have to do something about it. And like, it popped in the Brooklyn game last night, but you've also seen it throughout the season. Like I mentioned, the assist numbers from early on. Like, some of the skip passes that he's layering in off of these drives, it's not complete for him, but I've been very impressed with like the timing of some of these weak side passes that he's tossing, the placement on those, the velocity they can get into with those as well. So like, the scoring and the playmaking package has been pretty strong. The last young guy I wanted to ask you about, and then I have a lineup question for you. Kasper's Jakichonis, as he's gotten more minutes over the second half of the year, he is shooting the leather off the ball. I've been so intrigued by like the defensive possessions, because you could tell teams are like, oh, that's a rookie guard. Let's put him in action. Let's get him switched on. Let's try to bully him. And like, he does lose some of those reps, but the fight that he has on some of those, like, he's not afraid of anyone. And I appreciate that portion. And like, you can kind of see that same audacity offensively with some of the threes that he's taking and some of the drives he's trying to get to. The efficiency inside the arc hasn't necessarily been there, but like, conceptually, I have liked a lot of what I have seen from him. So Coop, for you, like, what were your expectations for him here? Did you figure he would be a piece of the rotation with Miami kind of slow play it with G League things? Or like, what do you kind of think about him heading in, and where are you at with him like that?
I figured they would slow play it a little bit, just because his age and being a young point guard in the league is unbelievably tough on offense. Very few guards kind of hit the ground running in terms of being a high usage point guard or anything like that. And there was a bit of an adjustment process that you could see happening in the whirlwind of draft summer league. They were trying out pieces of the new offense in summer league. And look, he's, for most of his life, he's been a pick and roll point guard. And all of a sudden you're drafted to a team where you're expected to be a playmaker without screens, really, in any way. I think that's been an adjustment. I don't even know if this offense is necessarily like, it's been so good for some guys, but he might be in that BAM category where it's a little bit different. And there, you have to figure out what your place is, because you're not using advantages created off screens. But, you know, he's shooting the ball so well that he's bought himself a lot of development time on the floor. The shooting has kind of earned him minutes on the offensive side. If he's shooting like that and he eventually, you know, learns coverage reads and all that kind of stuff, you're looking at a player. You just, you know, the finishing inside the arc will come. I just think the finishing inside the arc has also been down a little bit because he's attacking these isolation situations versus a pick and roll where he has the threat of the lob or a pocket pass or the floater. He doesn't have those multiple read possessions as much as he probably has in the past. But to your last point about his toughness, unbelievably tough. You know, Steve and I, we watched a lot of our Vias Sabonis back in the day. A lot of tough Lithuanian guys. Kasper is exactly that kind of a guy. He plays defense with his chest. He doesn't get tossed around. He's still not as big as strong that he will be eventually. But you can tell that he does not, you know, he's not a guy who goes in thinking, I'm going to lose that fight. He thinks he's going to win every fight when he's on the floor. Whether or not he does or not doesn't really matter to me yet. We'll see where he is defensively in 3 years, what he becomes eventually. He's got quick hands. He reads the floor well. I just think the world of him as a player, I think right now a lot of it's just been shooting and defensive toughness and play a small role, a simple role. What he's going to become, we'll see, and it's going to be a couple of years. He could become something pretty special. We just haven't really seen the playmaking be truly unlocked yet, because that's what's going to make him special eventually.
Yeah, he's even in his limited time, he's put some fun passes on film. Okay, question for you both to kind of close things out. I'll start with you, Coop. What is Miami's best lineup? If we get to 5 minutes left in a play-in or playoff game, what is the grouping that you would like to see on the floor for them?
I will give you my best answer, and that is I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. We just have not seen the guys on the floor together enough. I don't know if we know. I don't know if Spo knows. I don't know if there's any possible way that you could have that information. We're all just guessing at this here. And we don't know, you know, when Tyler came off the bench a little bit when he came back, and then Norm got hurt, and then Tyler's starting again. If and when everybody is healthy, are they going to start together? Is one of them going to come off the bench? Do they ever want to go back to starting two bigs? You know, right now they're doing this funky rotation move where Bam is almost being pulled early, and then he's being reinserted into the game 2 minutes later to play with Kalel. and then Bam comes out again and Kalel's staying in the game throughout that whole shift. Does that mm-hmm. continue when you've got all your guys ready to go? I don't know what the best lineup is going to look like. We haven't talked much about Davion Mitchell. He's been incredibly important to them as a on-ball defender, unlocking some of their switching, his playmaking, his ability to be physical on drives. I wish I could give you a better answer than that. I just think this team has a lot of talent and skill that we haven't seen together on the floor yet. And they've only got a few weeks left, but we could be going into a situation at some point where they're going into a playoff game or a playoff series, and they're still trying to figure out, or just going with their best guess as to what their best nine-man rotation is. That could be the story of the season, is that you get to the last week or two, and they're still just, hey, we think this is the best thing we have, but there's not necessarily, you know, 1,000 minutes of data to support it. You just got to figure out and treat the season, you know, go with what the season is put in front of you. And I think they're doing that so far. But right now, I don't know. And we'll see.
Yeah, hey, that's fair. Steve, do you have a line of thought?
I have a guess. The okay. one I want to see. I will say, speak for myself. Give me Davion Mitchell, Tyler Hero, Norman Powell, Andrew Wiggins, Bam Adebayo.
Okay. I like it. I think to the data that we have right now, Miami's most used lineup right now is Davion, Powell, Wiggins, Bam, and Ware. Minus one in 142 minutes, but trending upward. And again, when Norm Powell gets back, we will see what that ultimately ends with. As we're looking at other stuff, Mitchell, Powell, Larson, Wiggins, Bam is plus 62 in 110 minutes. And I kind of want to see more of that if you're going to have the defense pretty much like at the 1, 3, 4, and 5 spots. And then Norm, like, you just be a flamethrower for us. Get into those off-ball actions with Bam, get into those quick drives. Everyone has the freedom to attack. Like, that feels like a nice balance. But again, like, that's without Hero. So, like, to your point, Coop, like, I don't know how you factor in the fact that you have, like, three guys that can get you 20 at any given time between Norm, Hero, and Bam, and then finding enough defense around that. Like, for me, heading in, like, I think Wiggins is going to be in, Bam is going to be in. After that, like, you can kind of piece it together any way you want, and I probably won't sneeze at it, honestly. But, like, those two seem to be the most locked in. Actual final question for you, Coop. Where can the people find you? Where can the people find your work?
You can find us. We've got a lot of videos on the Heat YouTube channel. We have a great team over there. We've got the After the Buzzer podcast. We're putting up YouTube shorts. We've got a ton of featured content, a lot of on-demand content on YouTube. So please come subscribe. We have a ton of content. We're putting a lot of effort into building out this YouTube channel. Always a lot of analysis there. You can find me on Twitter at CoopNBA, on Blue Sky. And then we've, of course, got articles up on the web, up on heat.com. Anywhere in the Heat space, you can find us somewhere, but YouTube for sure. Come on over and subscribe, and we'll give you a lot of good stuff there.
There we go. Thank you so much for joining us and rocking with us. It was a blast. Excited to see what a Heat Hornets looks like later tonight. So certainly going to be tapping in with that. Man. We appreciate you, man. And we are back with this episode of the Dunker Spot. Steve, we're going to close with a couple of news items, one on the NBA side, and we're going to put a bow on the unrivaled season. But first, on the NBA side, Jason Tatum is slated to make his return later tonight against the Dallas Mavericks. Cooper Flagg also returned Thursday night, so we'll see if he plays on the second night of a back-to-back. It will be cool to have, like, Tatum and Cooper Flagg in that one. But either way, Jason Tatum making his long-awaited return has been kind of teased more heavily over the last like month or so, practicing, getting pictures and videos and things. But now he's back. Steve, for you, what are you going to be looking for in the Tatum debut?
Well, I mean, I think one, you just give a salute to Jason Tatum for the effort that he put in to get back on the court. Now, you know, I was captain of, hey, find a hobby, relax, chill, don't worry about it. But he put the work in. We've seen the work that he put in, and he's got himself to a place where everyone's giving him the thumbs up to play. And that's a grueling and tough effort. And, you know, you got to kind of tip the cap, number one. Number two, it now becomes, okay, what do you do analyst-wise as far as Jason Tatum's game and his contribution to the Celtics? Because it's like, hey, it's good to see you back on the court. and Boston has kind of been an established team. Jason Tatum has an established game, which kind of leads me to a little bit of the discourse that I've seen, which doesn't make any sense to me at all. I don't understand why we're talking about Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown in this manner in 2026. In big 2026, we need to clock the T and not do this ever again anymore. There's no reason for us to be doing this because we've seen them win a championship together. They are a good duo. They're fine. Like a lot, I'm not moved by this discourse, Nikias. There's plenty of room for both of them to operate, especially, and you could argue there's even more room with how this roster is built for both Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown to do what they do best, which is get buckets and make plays. And I think when one of my favorite stats to track earlier this year, I said it on the pod. I liked looking and seeing, hey, how many of these field goal attempts came from Jaylen Brown, Derek White, Peyton Pritchard, and at the time, Anthony Simons. I think there's room for Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown to both cook. I think it'll be okay. I think they'll be fine. It'll be good. But overall, it's just, okay, what's the health look like? What's the defense look like? How does he recover? How many drives are we seeing? Are we seeing pull-ups? What's the mix there? But, you know, if he's able to continue to look like himself, we'll see the talent display. It's Jason Tatum. He's really good.
He is incredibly good at basketball. And this is why I wanted to get your opinions first. And I want to bounce off of that quickly because I have been so annoyed by the discourse. We're going to get there. To answer my own question, one, just on a baseline level, Tatum makes the debut later tonight. Is he starting or is he coming off the bench? And as such, like, what is the minutes cap going to be? Like, I don't think Tatum's just playing 35 minutes against Dallas later tonight. That does not feel realistic. I would assume it's going to be somewhere in like the 15 to 20 minute range without seeing like reporting on that front. Maybe Celtics media has hit to it. I just haven't seen it yet. So I apologize if I missed it, but I would assume like 15 to 20 minutes. And from there, what are these lineup combinations going to look like? Who is he playing with? Who is he playing around? How are the touches going to be divvied up? Defensively is where I'm really intrigued because like my main complaint with the Celtics for most of the season has been, ooh, I like the increase in ball pressure. Like, obviously, Derek White can still be very good. Like, they are a bit scheme versatile with the big room, but it is a lot more drop than you're used to with the Celtics. But, like, they struggled so much to end the possessions to start the year. For most of the year, honestly. They have quietly creeped into the top 10 in defensive rebound rate per clean the glass, Steve. Like, that's kind of, like, the last thing for the Boston thing if you had any kind of criticism for them. So now with Tatum back, he should help the defensive rebounding. And within that, how early do we see Jason Tatum matched up with centers? Because like one of my favorite parts of Boston's defense when he was healthy was we'll put you on a big, we can turn all these pick and rolls into switches. We have our big roaming elsewhere to muck things up at the paint. Like how quickly do they want to go to that gambit as Tatum works his way back? Like I'm excited to see what that part goes to. To the discourse overall, it has been so incredibly stupid. It has been so incredibly stupid. And I just, one, for Jason Tatum, he is incredibly good at basketball. He should help your basketball team. We should not be questioning if he's going to help the Boston Celtics. Of course he is. But like this thing where on one side, we have to have, it's Jaylen Brown's team now, like that really matters. As you pointed out, Steve, they have won a championship together. Who cares whose team it is? We don't have to do this. That doesn't matter. Neither one of the characters that y'all are pitting together in these conversations cares about it to that degree. Jaylen Brown does not care. More, you know, at least not past the extent of I have proved to myself and others that I can handle a bigger workload. I don't think he wants to kick Jason Tatum out the door. That's dumb. I don't think Jason Tatum, for who we have seen him to be, is like, nah, bleep Jaylen Brown. This is mine. I am now going to take 30 shots a game when I come back. Nothing about his game or his mentality and how he approaches things would suggest either of those two are going to be like fighting over the ball, Will Smith and Carlton Banks style at the end of that high school game when Carlton chucked the ball into the hallway. I don't think we have to do that. On the other side, this thing where if you even suggest that a star player that is entering a lineup like 60 plus games into a regular season is going to have an adjustment period of some sort. And that is taken as like you are disrespecting the entire Tatum lineage for whatever reason. It doesn't have to be that deep either. Like, why is this such a hard conversation to have? of all the stars who could potentially be trying to slot back into a roster, I don't think there are many that could slot in easier into a situation, and specifically the Boston situation, easier than Jason Tatum. And that's still going to come with, if Tatum's playing 20 minutes, who are those 20 minutes coming from? Are we not seeing Hugo anymore? Are we not seeing Jordan Walsh anymore? Again, like, when are these lineups going? What are the touches going to look like? Those things have to be figured out. I think it's okay to acknowledge, as good as Jason Tatum is, it may take 3 to 5 games for them to find the rhythm. And that's before getting into Tatum's going to go from 20 minutes to 25. He's going to go from 25 to 30. He's going to go from 30 to 33. That adjustment's going to happen, but I think it's going to be fine. We can say that without yelling at each other. We also don't have to turn into, we don't have to have round 87 of Jaylen Brown's team versus Jason Tatum's team. That's dumb. Nobody cares. Let them be good. Let's just watch Jason Tatum play basketball and watch the Boston Celtics, who have been one of the best teams in the league this year and one of the best stories in the league this year. Let's see what they do as the top of the Eastern Conference is. Oh boy. One day you feel really good about the Pistons, and the other day you look at the offense. One day you feel good about the New York Knicks, and one, the next day it's like, ooh, what's going on with Cat? Like, the Celtics have a prime opportunity. Let's just watch that play out. I hate this back and forth. And I always struggle with, like, we have to have a pulse of what the conversation is, and you don't want to add fuel to, like, what you think is a dumb conversation. But it's also like, if I hold this in, I'm going to be miserable as a basketball fan, so I got to say this somewhere. And so there we go. I'm excited to see Jason Tatum. Those are things I'm looking forward to. The conversation is stupid. Let's watch Jason Tatum play basketball.
Wow.
Sorry.
Just put the discourse bottle down, man. you don't have to sip the juice. You just put it away.
It's just in my face.
Drive past the discourse store, man.
You know what it is, Steve?
What?
You know what it is? It's that episode of SpongeBob when SpongeBob and Patrick were like going through like the perfume shop, and it's just like that. It's just in your face, and like they put on the mask, and then like a hand reaches out and they like remove the mask and spray it directly in the, like, it's just that. And this is so dumb. But either way, congratulations to Jason Tatum on the rehab. I'm very excited to see him play basketball again. The Celtics team is going to remain very good. Now, to close things out, Steve, the unrivaled season officially ended on Wednesday night. And buddy, we got ourselves a game. We got ourselves a pair of insane performances. The Mist, or Mist BC, they win the championship 80-74 over Phantom BC. Breanna Stewart, 32 points on 15 shots. She only missed 4 of them. 4 boards, 4 assists, 4 stocks, 2 steals and 2 blocks in that one. Kelsey Plum, 18 points in the first quarter. Oh boy, it made me laugh, and I wrote about this in like my takeaways piece from the game. But like, start of the second quarter, Kelsey Plum is having a conversation with someone, and she's like smiling, and like while this is happening, there's just the graphic under her name: Kelsey Plum, 18 points. Rest of team, 6. And I'm just like, ah, well, this is pretty loud. She ends with 40. She was incredible. So, Steve, just for you, like, what were some of your major takeaways from this one? What were your favorite parts of that game, and what do you kind of make of this missed season overall?
Well, I mean, the Mist had the roster. They had the talent to just kind of wear and poke at you in different ways. I think we saw that, especially in this playoff run. The Alana Smith was great. Arike was great. Once again, we have Stewie. We have Alicia Gray. Like, we can just kind of do different things and shape shift towards what you're doing while also being able to exploit different things on our end. We can go to the post. We can space the floor. We can get to different actions. We can always have a screener on the court. We can feel a comfort on both ends. And I think it's just, okay, you think you're in a good spot, and now it's, oh, that's right, Arike's caught the ball at the elbow, and Stewie's going to screen, and there's no one on the other side of the court. What do we do? They just kind of found ways to put pressure on you offensively. They found ways to score. And then defensively, they just never were fun to deal with. And so I think it's a big salute to the Mist. And that's right. You got to say unrivaled champion Lee Rue, Nikias, and don't ever forget it. But, you know, I think everyone kind of bought into their roles. Everyone bought into the team structure. And I think that's where you have that third quarter stretch where, I mean, it was a back and forth battle. You know, we talk about the Dog and the Phantom. You know, Kelsey don't have a lot of points, but they were giving the effort. It was, what, 61-58. And then you look up at the end of the third, it's like, wait a minute, they're a lot closer to that target score than y'all are. This isn't ideal. I personally would say we need to figure out a better way to end games than on a singular free throw. just for my personal consumption. That's just my thing. I understand the rules. I understand what happened. It is what it is. But that game was too good, and that comeback was getting too close for, oh, well, it is a free throw, and it's over.
I know how much you in particular love foul and free throw talk on this podcast. I know it brought you great joy to have that be the end of the game and thus a conversation point in this segment. But no, I think to that point, Steve, well, actually, before I get there, let's circle back to the game. Incredible game. And like, there were so many swing possessions in this one. Again, Kelsey Plum and Brianna Stewart ultimately stole the show in this game. But like, watching Kiki Irifin on the offensive glass in that matchup was incredible. I was like, oh man, like some of these finishes, like what you mentioned on the preview pod we had with Miles. It's like, well, the finishing can kind of be up and down, but like her work on the offensive glass was very important. And I think that helped kind of keep Phantom afloat when we get to the second quarter, and it felt like the Mists were beginning to find the beat on what they want to do with Kelsey Plum. Like, okay, a little bit more ball pressure into these ice reps. We're closing the gap a little bit more when we do have to switch against her, et cetera. Now, again, she ended with 40. So like, she eventually got right back to answers, but like, watching them kind of piece through that was fun on the Phantom side. And then for the Mists, Arike Ogunbowale, once again, big shot after big shot after big shot. Alanna Smith, once again, big shot after big rebound after big finish. Like, her versus the smaller group when Phantom went pretty much all guards. It's like, yeah, I'm just going to deep seal and take in these like turning hook shots and some of these fades. The fades kind of got me. I'm just like, you're bigger than them. But like, either way, she was able to win those advantages enough, and she was huge on the glass. And one thing I wrote about was that end of the first quarter / early second quarter stretch, where it's 24-18 Phantom because of what Kelsey Plum was able to do. And then you get Alanna Smith shot, Alanna Smith boards, Alanna Smith dime to a cut in Arike Ogunbowale. It's like, you just need those to kind of keep you afloat before your star gets back. So you got enough of those. Some key drives from Alicia Gray in this one. Veronica Burton's defense in that second quarter I thought was huge. And then you get to the end of the game where fans are making this comeback, and it's like, man, maybe Kelsey Plum is just going to render all this moot. Like, maybe it just does not matter what the Mists have been able to put together this season in the playoff run and through the first like 3.5 quarters of this game, because you get to the target scores like, oh, it feels like the Mists are about to make their run, great close to the third, et cetera. And the fans were like, nah. And Kelsey Plum in particular was like, nah. Now, to your other point, it's generally less of a deal for me, like, hey, don't foul. You know what I mean? If you don't want the game to end in a free throw. But like, I certainly wouldn't mind if they shift this. And so the question I wanted to toss to you, Steve, is like, how would you like this to be handled? Because I've seen a couple of, I think Miles, Kia Stokes, also Threads, if you follow her there, like she suggested, hey, if the other team's near the target score and you commit a shooting foul or you're in the bonus or something, instead of it being free throws potentially ended, you lose a point whenever you commit a foul. Like, do you think that is a way to balance it? Or do you have any other ideas aside from what we currently have with free throws potentially ending it?
I mean, I just do like the one-on-one tournament. If it's literally in that one specific scenario, you get a second foul. Next one, you get a free throw. That's on you.
I see.
But check ball.
Check ball. I respect it. I felt for Tiffany Hayes in that moment. Very well designed. We're going to go cross screen into an inverted pick and roll for Brianna Stewart. Tiffany Hayes slides in to try to take the charge. And like, she got to the spot first, but because she's kind of like leaning in and / bracing herself for Stewie's layup, she's not in legal position. So like, it was the right call, but it's just like, I understood it was correct, but I didn't love it. And then it feeds into your point, like, oh, now this is also just ending on a potential free throw. But like, heck of an effort for Tiffany Hayes on that one. And her reaction, I think everyone kind of dealt with, was they're given the call. And you can hear her very loudly on the broadcast. How? I beat her there. What do you mean that the call's been overturned and she's getting to take the free throw? But either way, great game, great season. Brianna Stewart has added yet another trophy to the case. She has literally won everywhere, Steve. Also, Brianna Stewart, finals MVP. I want to add that in as well. But she has literally won everywhere. It's kind of crazy when you like write it out. But fun season nonetheless. And with that, thank you for listening to and or watching this episode of the Dunker Spot. If you haven't already, please subscribe. Apple, Spotify, RIP Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcast, you can find us. Subscribe to the Yahoo NBA YouTube channel if you haven't already. Fun pods and some fun content coming your way next week, so be on the lookout for that. You can follow me on socials at NikiasNBA. You can follow Steve on socials at SteveJones20. And with that, we will catch y'all next week.